Welcome to the Walking Through Time podcasts. There are plenty more to make your visit to New Norfolk more enjoyable.
Well, the Bush Inn was operating, I think, about 1815. And it's not called the Bush Inn because it was in the bush, because it was named after Robert Knopwood's secretary, who was a Mr. Bush. And anyway, it was regarded originally as a bit of a den of iniquity, one thing or another, you know. The police suggested to Mrs. Bridges that she should have it licensed so they could properly keep an eye on it and one thing or another and lay charges if necessary. So that was built, and I think it was 1825, something like that, I think. It was actually licensed. In the early days, that was the headquarters for all people have meetings there and all this stuff. It was the centre of the town, you know, it was the hub of the town in the early days. And you see when all sorts of organisations had their meetings at the Bush Hotel.
Even churches.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, there's a christening font there, isn't there, that came from... Yep, that's right. And then, of course, it went on to... Mrs. Bridges then built the what is now the used to be the Methodist Manse down there. She in Pioneer Avenue, and she moved there. Then it went through various owners, I presume, after that. And eventually, it came that the most I know about it to the Cowburn family, and they were very well known. They'd been hotel keepers in New Norfolk for. Some time they had the Star and Garter, and then they moved down to the Bush, and it had been added on to by then. Anyway, the what happened then, which made it famous, was because William Wallace he admired the view, and there is a wonderful view right down to the bend in the river, and he's reputed to have written the aria "Scenes That Are Brightest" from. The Opera Maritana, sitting on there. Anyway, this story persisted, and in 1926, I think it was, Dame Nellie Melba came to New Norfolk. She was in, they put the ABC broadcast excerpts from the Opera Maritana, and she sang "Scenes That Are Brightest," and the recording of it is in a glass case up above the. Fireplace in the main room there. That of course made it a very famous place. You'd like to say the Bush Hotel.
In 1924, the largest concert audience ever assembled, an estimated 4,000, crowded into the Hobart Town Hall to applaud and worship. Amongst them was a 16-year-old boy whose parents then owned the Bush Inn at New Norfolk, where the great Melba was staying for just 12 and 6 a night, all inclusive.
I was a boarder scholar at the Hudson School in Hobart, and of course when the news reached me I couldn't get home quick enough to see where Melba was and see all about her, never expecting to ever see her, of course. But as I went through the hotel I rushed up the stairway to my mother's private suite just to get the news of Melba, and of course I pushed the door open like madly, and instead of my mother, there was Melba sitting on my mother's favourite chair. Melba, I wanted to get out as quick as I could, but Melba seemed to want it otherwise, and she sat me down and talked to me, and she asked me all about myself and what I was doing, but I tried to ask her about herself.
But what did you think about her?
Oh, she was a rather wonderful woman. She's a rather big woman, but extremely pleasant, and she gave me this picture just to as a souvenir of a visit to the hotel.
And people, it was just in the era then when the wealthier people started to get cars, you know, and a trip to New Norfolk was lost like a nice little trip that they did, you know. So it became a place for people to go for the weekend. And Bill Cowburn, he went off to Holland and they owned right down to the river, almost to the river, except for the esplanade along there. And he brought back all these tulips and bulbs and one thing and another, and they had the most magnificent gardens there. And you know, you could get a gardener for $4 a day or something like that in those days. And yes, and then they had to you know, imitate the English scene for going away for the weekend. They had these dinghies down on. They couldn't have punts, of course, but they had these dinghies down at the river. So people would come up, you see, and stop at the hotel, admire the gardens, and go for a row at the on the river and so forth. That's how they spent their weekend. Well, in the somehow or another in the Historical Society, we acquired one of the visitor books there, and the people were asked to write their experience. And somebody wrote down, very nice, of course they had the good wines and all that sort of thing, you know, it was really upmarket, and they had these good wines, and somebody wrote, very enjoyable, but very expensive, or something other like that. And somebody wrote underneath it, if you couldn't afford it, why did you come? And of course, then it deteriorated. And I can well remember we used to play golf down at Millbrook Rise in those days. And there was a bit of a clubhouse there, but there was no 19th hole. So after we played on Saturday afternoon, we'd go up to the Bush Hotel, was like the 19th hole. And I can still see Les Cowburn there, who was, you know, well into his 70s by then, something or other. And Les would sit at the bar with a barrel behind him. And if you wanted a beer, you had to go up to Les. He wouldn't come to you. You had to go up to Les to get a beer. And he'd serve it out of this green enamel teapot. And he used to fill that up from the barrel, and then he'd pour it out from there. So eventually, of course, the Cowburn family went on then. And God, I've never been the same since, you know.
I can talk to you a little bit about some of the people that had meetings and were in attendance at the Bush Hotel over the years. Specifically, I refer to one of my favourite subjects. There were seven Irish political prisoners sent out to Tasmania or Van Diemen's Land in 1849. They were all gentlemen, headed by a guy named William Smith O'Brien, whose brother was the Lord Inchiquin. Smith O'Brien was 26 years a member of the Westminster Parliament and headed up a group of Irish people that tried to establish a uprising against the British. And this is in the middle of the potato famine. Now, of these particular guys, they met at the Bush Hotel at various times. Smith O'Brien was domiciled at Glendurwin, which is a dropkick away from the Bush Hotel. Of those people, Smith O'Brien, for instance, has a statue in the middle of O'Connell Street, in the middle of Dublin. John Mitchell, one of the young islanders who escaped to America, he'd brought his family out, but often visited Smith O'Brien at Glendurwin. They'd meet at the Bush Hotel. He eventually escaped to America, set himself up with the South in the American Civil War. His son, also John Mitchell, was the first commissioned foreign officer in the Confederate Army. He was an officer in the South Carolina Artillery. The first day of the American Civil War, April 1861, he fired the first effective shot in the American Civil War, the kid that was in the Bush Hotel. He went on to become the commander of Fort Sumter, where the war started, and he was actually killed by a shell fragment as the commanding officer of Fort Sumter. Mitchell's had two other sons. The youngest one was killed at Gettysburg. The middle son survived after being badly wounded. He went on to become the chief of the New York Fire Brigade. His son became the youngest mayor in the history of New York and died in a flying accident in the First World War. The other guy that would have met there with them, Thomas Francis Marr, brilliant orator, a young guy, married a New Norfolk girl or a girl from Plenty. He had a cottage built at Lake Sorrel. He escaped, and after he escaped, his wife returned to her home at New Norfolk, gave birth to a child who died at 4 months of age and is buried at St John's Church at Richmond. Beautiful little grave outside the door of the Catholic Church at Richmond. As I said, he escaped to America, became a lawyer. He officiated as a lawyer in a case, was the very first in the world, where a guy was freed on temporary insanity for murdering someone. He then became a general, a brigadier general in the US Army in the American Civil War, went on to become acting governor of Montana, and was murdered by the renegades. Yeah, so that's about those young islanders, but they were all associated with the Bush Hotel. Now, prior to the conviction and being sent to Van Diemen's Land, Thomas Francis Marr, along with Smith O'Brien and a couple of other people, went to France, who were in turmoil at the same time, to try and garner support for their uprising against the British control in Ireland. During the time, they'd met up with some ladies who were supportive of their cause. The ladies gave them some silk materials to represent a flag, green, white and orange. They took that flag back to Ireland, and that is the national flag of Ireland.
Smith O'Brien was a significant figure in New Norfolk because, as Leon says, he was a Glen Derwent. Well, that was known as Elwyn's Hotel then, in those days, private hotel. And he was the bane of the governors of Tasmania because his father was a member of the House of Lords. And Smith O'Brien, of course, as Leon says, was a gentleman. And he had great influence, you know, everybody in the colony, because he was the son of the Lord. All the ladies and they wanted to have him at their, you know, at their place to introduce them to their daughters. And, you know, they had an English son of an English lord staying there, one thing or other. Anyway, so he would write back to his father and tell him all the things that were wrong with Tasmania, you know, what the governors were doing wrong and all this sort of thing. His father would bring it up in the House of Lords, you see, and of course then the colonial secretary would write into the governor and say, what's this I hear about so-and-so and so-and-so, you know? And Smith O'Brien, he caused, quite an upset there. Well, subsequently, this is going back to my family, he was pardoned eventually and he went back, but he wasn't allowed to go to Ireland, and he was in France. Now, my great-grandfather, he was a member of the same clan, you know, like the O'Briens that Smith O'Brien belonged to were Protestants. Only 6% of the O'Briens in Ireland were Protestants. That was because Lord Inchiquin, when they had the Act of Union, the Irish lords were allowed to either keep their land if they became Protestant, or if they decided to, they still want to be Catholic, their lands were confiscated. So Lord Inchiquin, to his discredit, I think, decided to switch sides. So that's how our part of the family came to be Protestants. Yes, well, my great-grandfather...
Nice of you, I didn't think. Not very nice of you, I didn't think.
No, quite agree.
if I may cut in there, what the other interesting thing, reading the diaries of, at the time of these guys were here, Denison was the governor.
Yes.
And he was an authoritative bloke.
Yes, yes.
A bit like Lady Franklin, he was whipped up by his wife.
Yes, yes.
And when you read the diaries, mainly containing copies of letters she was writing home to her mother, there was obviously great jealousy against Smith O'Brien because he outranked the governor in the establishment way, and he was highly intelligent. He was, and he'd had the equivalent, he was a trained lawyer and that never ever practiced. But to pick up this jealousy thing in the diaries is fascinating.
Yeah, we'll see. My great-grandfather, he had the onerous job during the Crimean War, and the Irish soldiers returning from the Crimean War went through France here, and it was my great-grandfather's job to try to tell them that if they were going back to Ireland, they turned to Protestantism, they'd get a much better deal than if they went back as Catholics, you see. Anyway, it was there that he met Smith O'Brien, and Smith O'Brien said to him, look, there's wonderful opportunities in Tasmania, hunting, nothing like that. So when my grandfather was born, my family moved here to northern Tasmania, and they got a job straight away because they had references from Smith O'Brien and one thing, and that's how we came to be in Tasmania, kind of thing. So.
The Walking Through Time project has been made possible through the assistance of the Australian Government's Your Community Heritage Program and funding from the Derwent Valley Council. We would like to thank the many members of the public who have given freely of their thoughts and memories to make this project a success.